represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And we're trying to get everything adjusted here in the old studio.
You mean the virtual?
In the virtual, yes.
Faculty
in the
lounge.
In the old, in the faculty, in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. That is right.
Coming up on today's show on Profiles in IT, we're going to talk about the guys that started YouTube. We're also going to go back into the Wayback Machine and talk about the Cantenna.
And we're also going to talk a bit about visual perception as it relates to Dressgate.
I've sort of been following this, although I'm kind of bored with it, honestly.
Yeah, but I'm going to talk about the...
Okay, but you'll make it
I'm going to talk about the physics.
You'll not, bring in the science it's of the, it.
I'll talk about the science behind it. Yeah, I've heard all of the arguing back and forth, but we're going to talk about the science behind it. And I've had real examples of this because when I do scuba diving, I notice that I take one picture with my camera, but my eye actually sees the correct colors, even though it's different. And so your perception actually makes changes to what you see.
Didn't we have an email about this recently?
We did, but I've actually experienced what's going on and why people are seeing these different things. So it's actually worth talking about because it gets back to perception. And so I thought, okay, I can really handle that. And of course, we had a huge, huge mailbag.
Guy Gundy.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
It bounced.
We got an email from Arnie in Crownsville. Hi, Dr. Schertz. You touched briefly on Tech Talk this morning, something about the FCC ruling. It's still very confusing to me and probably also to others. Hopefully you can go over this FCC ruling more in detail. I'd like a free market rather than the government. But since the FCC's made their move, what's next, Arnie in Crownsville? Well, Arnie, I did talk about that last week. Here is the real issue, and I'm going to talk more in detail about it in the show, but this is the issue in a nutshell. There's tension between the telecoms and the internet content giants like Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Netflix. Now, the telecoms don't want to be treated like just a commodity provider of bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
They want to share in the economic boom that's known as the internet, with all of the streaming content and all of the e-commerce and all of the other things that are going on. On the other hand, Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Netflix and the like, which provide content, they say, look, we want to make money on the internet, but we want you telecom guy, you just be the pipe. You stay out of our business. So they're really fighting over who is going to generate revenue from internet commerce, whether it's going to be the telecoms or the providers. And that's what's going on now. And so the finding last week where the FCC said that internet service providers would be treated under Title II of the Communications Act of 1934 says that the internet service providers are just going to be treated as dumb pipes and that they really can't make any money from the internet. I don't think the government, through government regulation, should pick the winner and loser here. I think the marketplace should do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of it from a global nutshell, so to speak, Arnie. And I'll talk a little bit about this later on in the show. We got an email from Tung in Ohio. Oh, another Ohio deal, yeah.
And it involves pictures.
Yeah. Dear Doc and Jim, we take a lot of digital pictures. Whoops. My husband loves to photograph still life. His last photo sequence was devoted strictly to carrots. I guess he's like taking carrots in different scenes or something. I don't know what this is all about.
I don't even want to know.
What's the best way to print and display and save them? This has become a major challenge, and the number of pictures has climbed. Love the show, Thung in Ohio. Well, Thung, first of all, saving pictures is your first challenge. They must be stored in two locations. Could be an external hard drive in your computer's hard drive. It could be your computer's hard drive and cloud backup. Now, I like to use Carbonite, but you could also use Dropbox. You could use Google Drive. You could use Apple iCloud. You could use Microsoft OneDrive. But you want to have them backed up two places. So many times people think, oh, I've got all these pictures. I'll back them up to this external hard drive so then I can delete them from my computer. But then they're only on one place, so they're really not backed up. They have to be two places to be backed up. Now, I would also print pictures. I'm telling you, digital pictures have turned into the digital black hole. Have you ever seen, you know, you've seen people, they take pictures of everything, and nobody ever sees them again. They never print them. They don't look at them. They're just gone. It's a digital black hole. This is a big problem, actually. And it's even a bigger problem is that people's memories are tied up in this digital black hole, and they're just hoping that they won't be lost. So the advice is you ought to print your pictures so that in the event catastrophe strikes, you've still got prints of those pictures. Now, prints will last forever, and they're not subject to digital death. Now, what is digital death? Like you get a certain picture format, it takes a certain software package to read that particular file. So what happens if in the future the formats change, you don't have the particular way to read it, then you've got to go back and figure out how to do it. So it's better just to print them and make certain that you always have them in the future, even 50 years from now, because you never know. These carrot pictures could actually be classics. You don't really know what's going to happen there. Now, as for actually displaying them, there are a number of things that you could do that are pretty good to get pictures out of the digital black hole. Now, I like the idea of a Wi-Fi picture frame. For instance, you can get an 18-inch picture frame. That's 18 inches by 11 inches from NixPlay. It's a Wi-Fi cloud digital photo frame, and it's around, if you get the 8-inch frame, which would be 6 by 8, it's around $100. If you get the Wi-Fi frame that's 18 by 11, it's about $250. Well, this attaches to the Wi-Fi network. So then what you do is you just upload, you know, your last vacation, you just upload maybe 50 pictures from the last location to the cloud storage that this particular unit connects to, and they will be displayed on that digital frame. It just rotated through the digital frame. This digital frame will synchronize up to 12 frames. Up to 12 frames can be synchronized with this free cloud account. So, for instance, if you've got a grandparent that would like to see the pictures, but they can't really log on, they can't open their email, you could actually give them a digital frame, and it would sync up to that same cloud storage thing, and they could then look at pictures at their house. They would just they're rotating through automatically. Now, this particular frame has a motion sensor, so when nobody's in the room, it doesn't show anything. You walk in the room, it starts going through the thing.
Interesting.
See, that's a very nice way to display pictures. I think with this digital black hole, we've got to start figuring out ways to get the pictures displayed. I think it's a real issue. Now, you could also print them. Now, there are just a lot of online printing. I mean, printing is, you can print online. They'll send them to you. I started using Costco to print online because they're, well, face it, they're cheap.
Okay.
but the quality's pretty good. It's pretty good. Now, for instance, and what I particularly like, you can print on canvas. And you can make it, and you can make it look like a piece of art.
I have done this.
So, like, I could print a 24-inch by 32-inch canvas, which is wrapped around the frame, like museum mounting. 24-inch by 32-inch is only $60.
And they do that at Costco.
Yeah.
I see. I've had this done at Ritz, but I don't think Ritz exists anymore.
No. They do that at Costco. Now, you also could do, Costco does panels. Like, suppose you take one picture and spread it across three panels. It's like you want to have three panels, you know, above the couch.
Right.
Okay, so you could get a 56-inch by 36-inch three-panel set for $219.
That's not bad.
That is really good. And so my recommendation is you guys that are taking all these digital pictures and putting them in the digital black hole, let people see them.
Exactly.
Get a Wi-Fi frame and share them with friends and family. You could give these Wi-Fi frames, and then everybody could look at them. Then, secondly, start printing out selectively very high quality, prints on canvas, and then you can start showing them. So this was a great question, and I think this is a problem that many, many people have of the digital picture black hole.
I wonder how many of the pictures being taken in Ohio are actually suitable for framing, if you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, that is another question, mm-hmm. which is beyond the scope
yes.
of this show.
We just handle technology and leave it to your own devices.
Exactly. We got an email from Hawk and Bowie. Dear Tech Talk, I'd like to watch Netflix at home. However, my TV does not have an internet connection. Now, I do have Wi-Fi, but no way to get it to my TV. What are my options? Love the show. Hawk in Bethesda. Okay, this is the thing. There are several options, Hawk, that you can do to get Wi-Fi to your TV. First of all, you're trying to get a streaming device connected to your TV. Now, you could actually plug in something directly into your TV, to your HDMI port of your TV. You got Google Chromecast, which is a dongle that you could plug into your TV. Mm-hmm. It will connect to your Wi-Fi connection, and you can stream things like Netflix to your TV through Chromecast. That's $35. Now, I went on Amazon one time. I got mine for $28. So occasionally it's cheaper than $35, but normally it's $35. If you're an Apple fan, you might want to get Apple TV, and then it integrates with your iPad and your iMac, and you can have all kinds of slideshows. So Apple fans like Apple TV, and it's a small box that plugs into the HDMI port of your TV. That's around $99. It's Wi-Fi enabled. Some people like Roku. It's another dongle. It plugs into the HDMI port of the thing. Now, people like Roku, you can watch Netflix and different content through Roku, but Roku has a very nice remote control, so you can activate it. So for people that are, technology challenged, Roku many times is a little bit easier to use. So those are your three options if you just want to plug into the HDMI port of your TV. Now, there are other options too. Suppose that your TV doesn't have an HDMI port because you've got an old TV.
Right.
Now that could be a problem. So you actually then have to attach some other device to the TV that's connected to the internet. So everybody has a DVD player or a Blu-ray player. So the new DVD and Blu-ray players have Wi-Fi connection built in, and they're about $100. So you could get a DVD Blu-ray thing, and you just plug that into the video channel of your computer, and then you send the sound off to wherever your sound is being played, and you can then get your complete package. And so you play DVD through that player. You can connect through a web page which is built into the DVD Blu-ray player, and then you can attach to Netflix, and you can play all your Netflix things right through that. Now, if you're a gamer and you've got Xbox or PlayStation 2, those also have Wi-Fi connections, but they're a little bit more expensive. Mm-hmm. Now, like in the basement, my son was on. He always liked Xbox many years ago, so my internet connection in the basement is through the Xbox. Now, my internet connection in the kitchen, because that's a TV that didn't have internet on it, is through Chromecast. Now my main TV in the TV room, I just got a smart TV, and it has Wi-Fi built into it. So that's your third option. So I'm actually doing all three options at home. Your third option is you get a smart TV, Wi-Fi is built right into it. You can get a smart TV with 1080p, which 1080 progressive, that would be HD quality. It's less than $1,000, and they're coming down. But I got the 4K TV, the new Ultra HD TV, and you can get an Ultra HD TV which has 4,000 horizontal lines. It has four times the resolution vertically of HD, and it's called Ultra HD, and those you can get for less than $2,000, and mm-hmm. those prices are dropping fast. So those are all your options, Hawk. You've got the devices that plug directly in the HDMI port. port. You've got the external devices, either a DVD player or an Xbox player. And then, of course, you could just get a new TV, a smart TV. Those are all your options, and you go from all the way from $35 up to $2,000. We got an email from Andrea in Falls Church. Dear Doc and Jim, I've been asked to create a website for my employer, and I don't have enough pictures for the site. I can find lots of pictures on the internet, but I don't own them. And my employer does not want me to steal pictures. Very good choice.
That's a wise idea.
He's giving you very good advice. What are my options? I mean, we've got kind of a low budget, got less than $1,000 for all the pictures. I listen every weekend, Andrea in Falls Church. Well, Andrea, that's a good question, and I think your employer's right on track. You don't want to steal the pictures. You want to buy them. And you want to buy them royalty-free. Very important. And so there are a number of royalty-free sites that are out there. You've got iStockPhoto.com is one. You've got Shutterstock.com, that's one. You've got GettyImages.com, that's one. You've got Photolia.com, and then you've got BigStockPhoto.com. Those are five. Now, I've used iStockPhoto for years and love it. It's the kind of pictures that we need for our promotions at Stratford. But each of these sites is a different pictures, a different selection of pictures, different photographers. So you might find one site is better than another based on the kind of pictures that you need. Now, the nice thing is you can buy a picture which is suitable for web resolution for less than a dollar or $2. And then if you're going to then make a brochure or something, you need a high-resolution picture, you can also buy a high-resolution version of the same picture for maybe $10. So that's a very nice way for you to handle an integrated media campaign and always buy your pictures. So I'll have all of those websites listed in the show outline that we'll post to the web in a couple of days. There's also another idea. This is if there are any photographers out there. These websites are a great place for you to sell your photographs. Basically, photographers upload their photos to these websites, and they set the price that they want for them, and they can sell photos. And what this does, this will allow you to see what the public likes in the way of your photos, and it would inform you as to how to do additional photos. So I'm telling you, if you're a photographer and you got a lot of photos around, I'd upload to one of these sites and just see what the interest is of people who'd want to buy your photos. We got an email from Brian in Kansas. Dear Tech Talk, I love computers, and I want to learn about programming. What programming languages are in demand? I'm in high school now, but after college, I want to become a developer at a tech company. I listen to your podcast every week, Brian in Kansas. Well, Brian, at Stratford, all of our students have access to a site called Lynda, lynda.com. Lynda, it's a great site with a lot of tutorials on it, and they have a whole boatload of programming tutorials that we make available free to all of our students. And you can actually join Lynda if you want. It's not much if you join it as just an individual. So I've compiled a list of the 10 most sought-after programming languages according to the amount of usage and requests they get on Lynda. Now, here are the top 10. Number one, Java. Now, Java is a class-based object-oriented programming language developed by Sun Microsystems in the 1990s. It's one of the most in-demand programming languages, and it supports multiple platforms. Number two is the C language. C is a general-purpose programming language developed in the early 70s. It was actually the language that we used to write the Unix operating system. C is the oldest and most widely used language. Because it provides a foundation for other languages, many people learn that one first, and then they learn C++, which was sort of a follow-on. The number three language is C++. This is getting more difficult to learn now. It's an intermediate-level language. It's object-oriented, and it was designed to enhance the features of C. That's why it's called C++. And it powers major software like Firefox, Winamp, and Adobe programs. C#, that would be C with the little, what's that, numbers hashtag.
Right, yeah,
that
pound sign.
Pound sign, yeah. C pound sign, pronounced C sharp.
Or they do call it a hashtag now. I'm dating myself, aren't I?
Yeah, it's a hashtag now. But yeah, in the old days, it was something else. C sharp is a language that was developed by Microsoft as part of its .NET initiative. So people that want to program for the Microsoft platform and stay in the .NET ecosystem love C sharp. So that was the programming language number four in the list from Linda. Now, number five is Objective-C. Now, that's a general-purpose, object-oriented programming language. It's used by Apple. See, because if Microsoft has got one, Apple wants one.
Mm-hmm.
So Objective-C, it powers the Apple's operating system X. It powers iOS, as well as all their APIs. It can be used to create phone apps. So people that want to get into the Apple phone app business, you know, they want to learn Objective-C. PHP is a hypertext preprocessor. It's a free server-wide scripting language designed for dynamic websites. So a lot of websites have PHP where you can interact with them. The PHP can grab data and display it, can change the page dynamically depending on what data you request. PHP powers more than 200 million websites, including WordPress, Dig, and Facebook. So if you want to become a website developer, PHP is the go-to language. Python is a high-level server-side scripting language for websites and mobile apps. It's considered an easy language for beginners. It powers websites like Instagram, Pinterest, Radio. It's used by Google, Yahoo, and NASA. Ruby. Now we're down to number eight. Ruby is a dynamic, object-oriented scripting language for developing websites and mobile apps. Ruby was designed to be simple and easy to write. It powers Ruby on Rails, or something just called Rails. It's used for Scribd, GitHub, Groupon, Shopify. You want to pick one of these. You don't have to learn them all. SQL is a great language, a structured query language. That's a multi-purpose language for talking to relational databases. So if you've heard of Oracle, That's an SQL database. So all of the big databases are basically SQL. And so if you can program SQL, you can write queries, you can be very efficient at generating reports. So that's number 10 on the list. It's a great question. Actually, there are tutorials on Lynda for learning all of these. Just pick one and learn it. That's the best way to do it. We got an email from Ian in Greenbelt. Dear Tech Talk, whenever I receive an email, images are downloaded.
Not downloaded.
Not downloaded. Thank you. Thank you very much. I get this message. Some pictures have been blocked to prevent the sender from identifying your computer. Click here to download the pictures. Now, how does blocking the image download protect my privacy? Enjoy the show, Ian and Greenbelt. Well, Ian, there are two types of images in an email. One, they're attached, and the other one is remote. The attached email is exactly what you think. It's actually attached to the email, and when you read the email, you just see it immediately. But then that makes the email bigger and slower to download. And then the person that sent it never really knows whether you looked at the image or not. Now, the other kind is actually remote, and they just have a link to the picture. So you download the image, and then there's a link to a remote image. And then that link would download the image. Now, here's the thing. With spam operators, they love to know whether you're looking at that email. So what they do, they track whether you've downloaded an image. And if you've downloaded an image, they say, hey, that's a good email. Let's just send them more spam. So what you want to do is you want to block the spam. You want to block the image download for spammers. So what I do is, but maybe they're different businesses that you work with and you trust them. So you can put them on your white list, so to speak, and they will automatically download those images. But if they're not on the white list, they're not going to be downloaded unless you click yes. And so whenever it's a spam item, I never click yes, and I just delete it. And then they don't know whether I've looked at the email or not. And I'll tell you, this is exactly what we used to send out emails. We sent out emails through constant comment, which was a sort of an email blast device, and I would get back a report on exactly what links had been activated and looked at, so I would know what the activity was on that. So all of these guys that are using, you know, sending out spam to you, they're tracking in the background exactly what you're doing, and so it's very wise just to block all downloads unless you really want to do that. Listen, we love all your emails.
We do indeed.
Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll cover your emails on the air, or else we may actually write to you directly if it's like an emergency. And we also love you to check out our Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/techtalkonline and leave any comments, and we may cover them in the show.
It is Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, and 1039 FM HD2. We'll be back with more right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. Now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
And today we're going to talk about Chad Hurley, Steve Chen, and Jawed Karim. Jawed Karim, I think. They are founders of YouTube, YouTube.com. Now, Chad Meredith Hurley was born in 1977 near Birdsboro, Pennsylvania. He's currently the chief executive officer of YouTube. He received a Bachelor in Arts from the Indiana University of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Right after he graduated in the year 2000, he got a job at PayPal, really working on their interface or user interface, some of the graphic design. And one of his first jobs, he had to design the logo for PayPal. They're still using the logo that he designed on while he was at PayPal.
Classic logo.
Yeah, that was the classic logo. Hurley is an expert on user interfaces and was primarily responsible for tagging and video sharing aspects of YouTube. The second founder of YouTube, Steve Shi Chen, was born in 1978 in Taiwan. Chen is currently the chief technology officer of YouTube. His family immigrated to the U.S. when he was 8. He attended the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. After graduation from college, he became an employee of PayPal. I see. You see there's a kind of a trend here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. PayPal connection mm-hmm. here.
That's right. Chen was also an employee of Facebook, although he left Facebook several months before he was involved in starting YouTube. Jawed Karim was born in 1979 in Marsberg, East Germany. He currently serves as an advisor to YouTube without a formal position. His family moved to the United States in 1992. He graduated from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He left campus prior to graduating to become an early employee of PayPal, but he finally did, his parents are happy to know, that he finally did get his Bachelor of Science degree in 2004. As you might have expected, Chad Hurley, Steve Chen, and Jawed Karim met while working at PayPal. Now, YouTube was born one night when Hurley, Chen, and Karim wanted to share some videos from a dinner party with friends that they had in San Francisco.
That sounds terribly exciting.
Yeah, dinner party. But you don't,
here's the veal.
You really don't know what kind of party it was.
Yeah.
It was on January 2005, and all of the data doesn't really tell the details of that dinner party.
Uh-huh. Basically, my understanding was that for the first like 7-8 months that the site was in existence, it was operated
out of like one of these guys' garage or something.
Yeah. It was, I've heard that story, yeah.
Well, they tried to find a way to share this video, but, you know, video takes is a big file. Mm-hmm. They couldn't send it by email because it exceeded the size of the email attachments. It was hard to post it online because you couldn't get the right bandwidth, couldn't get the right interface. So they thought they'd try to design something simple. So they ended up creating a site where they could just post videos that they wanted to use personally so they could share them. And it turned out that this became a very popular site. I mean, they initially just did it for the fun of it, but it kind of became a popular site. Jawed uploaded the first YouTube video, the first official video, April 23rd, 2005. That was just 4 months after that dinner party. And I looked at that video, the first video. It was him. He was standing in the San Francisco Zoo in front of the elephants, saying, "Here I am, standing in front of the elephants, and it doesn't really look like they've got much to do today." It wasn't really much of a video.
You know, the elephants really don't have much to do but eat and recycle peanuts and hay all day.
Now,
you
know, so
I like the way you phrased that. Very broadcast appropriate.
Thank you.
But I want you to, now listen to this. Listen to this timeline. April 23rd, 2006. The first video was uploaded. April 23rd, 2005.
Happened so quick.
October 16th, 2006. That's less than a year and a half. Chen and Hurley sold YouTube to Google for $1.65 billion.
That's amazing.
It boggles the mind.
You think about that. Yeah. I mean, less than a year and a half. Now, it turns out Hurley's share was $345 million. That was in he was awarded 735,000 Google shares, and at that time that was $345 million. Google's gone up since then, so he's got a lot more. Chen's share was $326 million at the time. That was 625,000 shares of Google. Karim's share was $64 million, and that was 137,000 shares of Google. Now YouTube was not even profitable. It had no ads. It had no source of money. Basically, Google just wanted to get it so they could lock up the video market, and they were going to try to turn it into monetize it, as they say, in some way with advertising, which they haven't done yet. Google has said that so far the revenues from YouTube are immaterial. But this is interesting. There are so many videos. There are currently 83 million videos on YouTube. The bandwidth for watching all the videos costs $1 million a day for the bandwidth.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah. It's
Now, there's one interesting side note here. There was a company called Universal Tube and Rollform Equipment Corporation, and their web address was YouTube. Well, that would be the letter YouTube instead of Y-O-U.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the letter YouTube.com. And people got confused when they went to YouTube because they would type the letter YouTube instead of Y-O YouTube, and their site was just crashed all the time with traffic. They finally had to sell that domain name, and now their name is YouTubeOnline.com, and they sold it to a copycat site that wants to also deliver videos. So there's a case, three guys were at the right place at the right time, and they made a killing when they sold that.
It happened so quick that we can't even think of a time that right now where YouTube wasn't a major integral part of everything we
right.
do.
Is it possible that they'll ever recoup all of what they invested in this?
I think eventually there's so much traffic going to the site. I think they'll eventually integrate advertising with it, just like mm-hmm. they did with Gmail.
They're doing it now, but like you said here, it really is immaterial the amount of profits they generate from advertising because it's not across the board and it's only on selected videos.
Right.
Selected high hit count videos.
That's right. Yep. You know, I've got a video on YouTube which I just discovered.
Do you really?
It was one of our promotional videos at Stratford. Somebody uploaded it on YouTube. When
no
I was
kidding.
Looking around, I found it.
I have some things on YouTube that I don't really want to talk about.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. More Tech Talk coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Schertz. It's this guy right here. And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Russ. I'm the adjunct professor for messing things up and lowering the academic bar here on Tech Talk Radio. We just finished talking about the founders of YouTube on Profiles in IT. When YouTube first launched, their web address interfered with another company's web address. If you can give me either that company's name or the web address that was affected, you will win tickets for two for fine dining at Stratford University, either the campus in Falls Church at the Escoffier at Stratford University or on the campus in Woodbridge at Cafe Karim. Now, if you're calling us from east of Birdsboro, Pennsylvania, the number is 877-936-9333. Calling from west of Merseburg, East Germany, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line, as always, is 877-936-9333. Andrew Mitchell, adjunct professor for crowd control and prize distribution, is standing by to take your calls again at 877-936-9333. The Pop Quiz from Tech Talk Radio.
All federal agents listening should turn off their radios.
Uh-oh.
Right now.
There it is. This is the music that we had coming into the radio station.
That's right. Now, what were you doing in the car on the way in here?
Orale.
This is what I do. This is my war-driving music. Whenever I'm going out and looking at the access points in the area, I turn on my war-driving music, open up the radio, open up all the windows, stick my antenna out of the car, and drive around. So what I did this morning, I set up my put up my laptop in the car. I opened up a program called NetStumbler, which rings a bell every time I get an access point. And it tells me whether the access point is encrypted, what channel they're using, the signal to noise, and all the other things I like to know. And then it catalogs. It also gives me the GPS location of that particular access point. And as I drive along, my laptop is dinging as I pick up more access points. I have my dipole antenna stuck out through the moonroof. I've got my Cantenna antenna stuck out through the side window as I'm driving around Washington.
And so when you get in the car, does it sound like this?
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
That's it. That's it. You know, that's what. Whenever I'm out going out with my son to do war driving, that's it. He says, "Okay, Dad, hit it."
Obviously, he didn't come this morning on this. How long of a drive is it from here to from your house to here?
Well, I'm down I'm a southern boy from Virginia, mm-hmm. So it's probably 20-25 miles, I think.
Okay,
coming in, and on the way to the studio, I passed 420 access points.
And that's interesting because a lot of the time you spend on that road, on that trip, you're on an interstate highway.
I'm on an interstate highway. Now, the one thing that was very noteworthy, last time I did, I always try to evaluate Washington, D.C.'s level of encryption.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time, a lot of my neighbors were unencrypted. This time, every single one of my neighbors had encryption turned on.
That's because they know you live there.
I wonder if I have changed their behavior.
You might have. But it's funny, you said coming down River Road,
River Road, I'm telling you, is not encrypted. Those guys on River Road just aren't really paying attention to encryption. That was the lowest level of encryption of any neighborhood in my drive coming in. I passed a total of 420 access points. Encryption was turned off on 148 of them.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Doesn't River Road go, isn't it entirely in Potomac?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but the stretch of River Road Doctor probably drives is inside the Beltway.
Inside the Beltway.
That's not so much Potomac, but that's still...
This is the thing. On River Road, from inside the Beltway until I hit the District of Columbia line, the encryption level was probably running less than 50%. I mean, my overall average was something like 70%. Was encrypted, or 65% was encrypted, but that dropped below 50%. Once I got into the district, encryption picked up. So out of the total run this morning, 148 did not have encryption on. That means that 272 out of 420 did turn on their encryption. They're the good guys. So the last time I ran this, I did this a couple of years ago, Washington was running about 55 to 60% mm-hmm. encryption. So actually, we're much better now.
Yeah, that's about two-thirds, 66% or so,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, we're actually much better. Now, I was also interested in trying to figure out the level of technology. So this program, NetStumbler, also detects the access speed. Turns out that of the 420 access points, 365 of them, or 87%, were running 54 megabits per second. So we know that's 802.11g. Mm-hmm. That's the new technology, which actually has embedded in it the new encryption, WPA, WPA2. So we have the potential here of really being a very secure operation, a very secure town.
Well, once again, the benefit for encrypting your Wi-Fi is it's so other people don't get in and use it.
Yeah, really, it's not so much security, it's so that you don't have people hogging your bandwidth. Your neighbors say, well, why should I get internet access? You know, I just piggyback on my neighbors and I get it for free.
But by doing that, you open yourself up to potential viruses. If they go to sites that open their computer up to that,
well,
they could bring it in.
If your computer is not firewalled, mm-hmm. if you don't have a firewall on your computer so your hard drive's accessible to other people on your network, you could get viruses. That's probably unlikely if most people do have an internal software firewall on. But if they don't have it on, because you see, when you get onto the network, you are inside of the hardware firewall on the wireless network. Now, one of the big problems is, suppose your neighbor's son downloads illegal MP3s. Those illegal MP3s, of course, have been downloaded to your IP address.
Right.
So you're going to be the one who's sued for copyright infringement,
exactly.
Not your neighbor.
Exactly. And encrypting your Wi-Fi is actually very simple, isn't it?
It's extremely easy to do. You actually have to log on to your wireless access point, and it actually has a built-in web page. So you just have to go to the web address of your access point, and the web address is almost always the same. It's an IP address, and you can look it up in the manual. It's 192.168.0.0. In other cases, it might be .1 at the end. So it would be 192.168.0.1. You just look it up in the manual. You go to that web address, and the web page comes up. And then you log on to your access point. There's a username and user ID. And the default username and default user ID are in the manual. It's usually something like the administrator is blank and the password is admin. Or it could be admin username, admin password, something very simple. It depends on the particular brand. You log in, and there's a section called encryption, and you simply enable encryption. And you select whether you want what type of encryption, WEP, WPA, or WPA2. If you've got old computers in the house, you probably have to go with WEP because the old network interface cards only support that. But if you've got all new technology, you go for WPA, WPA2, which are more secure in that they have what they call a rolling key. The key changes often enough so it's hard to basically figure out the key quick enough. And you just simply select a key, and the access points, most of them have an automatic key generator for you. So you let it generate the key for you. You enable that key, write down the key so you don't forget it.
Good idea.
And then when you log on the next time, your computer says this is an encrypted channel. What key is it? You type in the key that you saved in your access point, and you're in. And if your neighbors don't have that key, they can't log in, so there's nobody's going to be hogging your bandwidth and maybe eavesdropping on your
whatever you're doing.
Whatever you're doing, if you have anything you don't want your neighbors to know about.
We want you to know that Tech Talk Radio airs every Saturday on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, online at techtalkonline.com and at federalnewsradio.com. Stand by. More Tech Talk coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. You are listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Let's talk about Dressgate.
Yes.
A little bit. I mean, there has been all the social media stuff. We'll talk a bit about the thing. Now, there was this shop in Birmingham which actually had a dress that was, blue and black or some dress. And they sold the dress to Cecilia Bleasdale, and she sent a picture to her daughter Grace to say how it'd be great to wearing the dress. And then she and her daughter each saw the dress as a different color. One saw gold and white, and one saw black and blue or something. They saw different two colors, and then they just couldn't agree on it. They shared this with social media, and it went viral. Now, here's the thing. Scientists have looked at this, and it's an illusion that occurs because of how the brain is wired to see color. See, colors are just a perception made by the brain when light hits the back of the retina at differing wavelengths, and the brain interprets these wavelengths as color. But it's doing something very clever. It actually adjusts it based on the illumination that's shining on it. So, like, if you see a white surface in a shadow, the brain knows that the shadow has changed the color of that because there are different colors of light shining on it. And the brain adjusts for that automatically so that even though the white is in the shadow, it looks white to you because your brain has made this perceptual change. So, and this actually happens to me. If I go diving and when I'm diving and I look around at the colors underwater, I see the colors because my brain is automatically adjusting for the fact that red is being filtered out by the water and things look on average bluer. And so it's making that adjustment, and I see the colors because my brain has made an adjustment. But when I take a picture, all the pictures look very, very blue, and I've got to actually manually do that color adjustment. So what happened here is that some people's brains interpret the blue color as a shadow on the white dress. So their mind just says, okay, that must be a shadow on a white dress. So it's not really blue. It's actually a shadow on a white dress. And so they just make that adjustment. Now, other people discount the shadow, and they see the blue and the black as the true color. So it's purely perceptual. Now, Andrew Hansen, the past chair of the color group of Great Britain, said that humans have been, through evolution, are programmed to think objects in the shadow are blue, We've sort of been programmed to do that. And the amount of adjustment that different people see sort of depends on their eye-brain connection and how they've processed it. Now, there's another factor, and that's the color temperature of the background, and that's confusing people. So different screens have different color temperatures. So, in fact, you may have two different displays, and it could look white and gold on one and blue and black on the other, just because of different color temperatures on those two screens. And so that's actually a difference in the adjustment on the screen. But two people could look at the same screen and see different colors because of this perception difference. So there you go, just a little bit about perception. And
pretty interesting.
It was actually quite interesting. And I'll tell you, you start looking around, and your eye is very good at adjusting for the reflected color temperature and making an adjustment to see what it believes is the true color of what you're looking at. So there you go. Dress gate revealed.
Okay.
Now let's talk about Vint Cerf, the plan to future-proof computers. Vint Cerf, of course, the father of the Internet, raised the possibility that centuries from now, file formats will become obscure and unreadable. I mean, I had a problem. I was looking at something I had 30 years ago. I couldn't find anything that I could read it with, and it was like it took a huge job because the programs I had that could read it would not load on the current operating system, and it was like a major job to get the thing done. So what he recommended is that you actually do something which you call wrap all of your pictures around what he calls a digital vellum, and you have everything you need to completely look at the file. So you wrap around, you say your pictures, you wrap around a picture viewer, and around that you wrap the operating system. So you've got a complete package of everything you need to view that particular photo, so that 100 years from now, somebody could then, using that digital vellum, they could look at the picture because embedded in that file format are all the applications needed to read the zeros and ones. He said this is really important. So like if you got a Photoshop file, your digital vellum will include Photoshop. And then if you've got an operating system, the Photoshop represent, you'd have digital vellum around that. And so you would end up having a fully self-contained file that had every single item that you needed. Now, we're already doing that with desktop publishing, where we embed all the fonts that we need. So this is just taking it to the next level. And he also recommended that print those pictures. You know, it's been, we just celebrated on January 25th the 100th anniversary of the first transcontinental phone call.
No kidding.
Happened 100 years ago. January 25th marks the 100th anniversary of what is often called as the first transcontinental phone call made by Alexander Graham Bell in New York City to his trusty assistant, Thomas Watson, who was all the way out in San Francisco. Now, the call also included President Woodrow Wilson, who was in the White House, and, of course, the AT&T president, Theodore Vail, who was in Georgia. The first ceremonial phone call line was opened January 25th, 1915. Now, of course, the first actual experimental transcontinental phone call was probably made about a year earlier when they were just trying to test it out and see how it would work. The 1915 call was part of the Panama Pacific International Exposition that year, a celebration of the Panama Canal's completion and a showcase of the newly revitalized San Francisco, which had been decimated by a 1906 earthquake and fire. In the conversation, the conversation was heavily scripted, and it was designed to bring publicity to the achievement. Now, the only genuine moment of the call was when Bell asked Watson, "Watson, are you there? Do you hear me?" Now, the first phone call was actually made in 1876, 39 years earlier. It was just a short phone call. This was when Bell called his assistant and said, "Watson, I want you to come over here." Now, in order to build this four-person phone call, you know, there were only four people on the line, AT&T had to build a coast-to-coast telephone system, included 130,000 telephone poles, 2,500 tons of copper, and it spanned 3,400 miles. But they finally did make it.
That's amazing. And I have appropriate telephone music playing for us
now. Here.
This would be ELO's telephone line.
Oh, yeah.
You'll pick up that telephone. And of course, course, Watson did pick up the telephone.
Right. Telephone. Okay.
All right. Sorry about that.
I've got some really.
I've been waiting all week to hear what you have to say about this.
What about the invisible boyfriend, or the drone?
Both, really.
Okay. Well, why don't we just go to the drone first? Because that's what you were thinking.
I've been itching to hear about what you think about what's going on with drones.
The DJI drones, DJI is, of course, the Chinese company that makes the Phantom 2 and the Phantom 2 Vision. DJI drones will be disabled over Washington, D.C. Now, following the crash of one of its Phantom drones in the White House lawn, the Chinese drone maker is reporting that it's going to be disabling its units from flying over the D.C. area. Now, according to the FAA, it's already against federal regulations to fly in the D.C. area. And it turned out that in addition to flying where he shouldn't have been flying, he told the Secret Service that he was drunk.
Do you get a DUD?
DUF, drunk while flying.
Yes.
A DUF.
DWF.
DWF, yeah. So it turned out that DJI had been watching this.
It's an FUI, flying under intoxication.
Oh, yeah, flying under intoxication. FUI, that's it. Mm-hmm. And so, thank you.
I'm here to help.
Our legal scholar is here.
Not quite.
So DJI has been watching this, and they really don't want to have their drones banned. So they said, you know, we better get on with this thing. So they decided to program their drones to stop flying whenever they're in the District of Columbia. It's in a 15-mile radius around D.C., mm-hmm. or whenever they're at a certain distance from airports. Now, it turns out that all the DJI drones have GPS on them, and it tracks the drone's position at all times, and if there are no fly zones built into the firmware, the drone won't operate. Yeah, so DJI is releasing mandatory firmware update for all Phantom 2 and Phantom 2 Vision and Phantom 2 Vision Plus drones in order to comply with FAA's notice to airmen.
A NOTAM, as we
notice,
call it.
A NOTAM, yeah, which restricts mm-hmm. unmanned flights around Washington, D.C. So this NOTAM that was apparently when I was flying the drone here at the WTOP building, I must have been violating the law.
I know nothing.
But, you know, it didn't feel like a violation.
Police car drove right past us when we were doing it.
That's right. And, you know, I flew right over the police station. I was buzzing the police station. Nobody said anything. But I'm thinking it could be a problem now because they're getting a little bit more visibility. Now, I actually have not downloaded the firmware upgrade to my drone.
I don't know that I've said that on the air.
So, but it's only because I haven't logged on. I'm certain as soon as
I'm sure you will too.
As soon as I log on, I'm going to take care of my firmware upgrade. That's not going to be any problem.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes.
You weren't finished. I can't wait till you're finished.
So the drone industry, they've agreed with Obama that more regulation is needed because they don't want drones, you know, just totally violated. So they're on board with this, and so is Congress. Now, another note. The FCC recently announced that drones can't be flown within 30 miles of the Super Bowl stadium. Now, the good news is that Super Bowl stadium will not be part of the firmware upgrade because the Super mm-hmm. Bowl changes each year.
You'll just get arrested if you do
That's
that.
Exactly right.
So when they finish with this firmware update, will it ban it from all airports in the country, or is it just a Washington, D.C. airport?
It's all, they have the GPS locations of all of the airports that have restricted airspace, so it will include all of that. Plus, but the only city that's actually banned is Washington, D.C.
That's it for this week. Join us next week on Tech Talk Radio, heard every Saturday at 9 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, and online at techtalkonline.com. There you can see all of our prior show outlines and download all of our past shows. Learn more about our sponsors by going to stratford.edu. We'll see you next week.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics. Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Federal News Radio's DoD Wednesday. At 3, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. At 4, in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a smart discussion on the issues and challenges of the defense community. Plus daily DoD updates, mornings and afternoons, Monday through Friday. DoD Wednesday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.